Welcome to the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility, an ongoing dialogue and inquiry into American political institutions and...
Pound away here at the Virtual Center. Parts piece in today's Washington is that we are in a situation right now in America where, in a sense, the opposition to the president has a bully pulpit as well. And it's conservative media. It's terrestrial talk radio. It's Fox News. And the fact of the matter is that bully pulpit never goes off the air. It continues to pound away and pound away and pound away to the point. And I haven't had time to work this out, but it just occurred to me, it's probably going to be very, very difficult for the bully pulpit nature of the presidency to counter this. In fact, it's not been that effective. And the result is, when the president makes a misstep, be it Benghazi, be it the rollout of the Affordable Care Act, the attack becomes so overwhelming and so furious that it clearly takes the initiative away from the White House and puts the initiative with the opponents to the White House. I think we're beginning to appreciate, at least I am, the power and influence and the potential of conservative media in terms of what it's been able to do. I read Capehart's piece about the GOP destroying the country. And I began to consider some of the information in it, whether it's obstruction, whether it's opposition, whether it's the filibuster, whether it's refusing to appropriate money for particular pieces of legislation, even pieces of legislation that are the law of the land, like the Affordable Care Act, whether it's the refusal to confirm appointments to courts and circuit courts and other federal inferior courts, whether it's the unwillingness to appoint directors of federal agencies. It seems like every single activity that Congress is required to perform in order to support the agenda of the White House is in some way being sabotaged, obstructed, undercut, disapproved, not funded, or whatever. And the point that Capehart makes, that I think is probably for me the most poignant, is that they're doing this, everybody can see what they're doing, but the rest of us in the middle don't know what to do about it. We can't figure out how to deal with it. It's unbelievable. My point is that one thing we can do about it is to maintain a voice like that reflected here on the Head On Radio Network. Not just the Virtual Center, but the other programming on the horn. It's more important than ever that this voice remain out there, because the sound and the fury coming from the other side, I would suggest to you, is overwhelming. It's overwhelming the administration. It's overwhelming the bulk of an American population. And I think all of us need to very, very carefully about what's liable to happen, especially if we start silencing alternative points of view and alternative positions. What we're dealing with is a situation where people have decided to take advantage of the loopholes and the extreme could happens but never will happen possibilities of our political system and our Bill of Rights. We are hearing speech. That used to be considered not just unsavory, but unpatriotic, treasonous. And it's so frequent, it's so common and so overwhelming that it just goes on and on and on. And I would suggest to you that that it's important that we hang in there and we continue to pound away and make clear what the apparent agenda is. We're dealing with a two-party system where one party is trying to do something and the other party has decided that it is not going to allow anything to be done. It opposes everything. It proposes no alternatives to anything. So in other words, the objective seems to be dysfunction. And I think in some ways it's happening. We've all got to realize that this is indeed happening. So again, I guess what I'm saying is for 10 minutes here, what I've effectively, I hope, done is make a case for the significance of a voice like the Hit-On Radio Network. And I personally, on behalf of the folks at the Virtual Center, I personally see it as an honor to be here and have the opportunity to share with you some of these very, very important insights and perspectives, because they're not going to come from anywhere else. At least I don't think so. If they did, if I could see them, I wouldn't be here. So with that, let's touch on a couple of things and begin today's program. And an issue that I wanted to raise, and this is kind of out of left field, has no relation to what we were doing yesterday or anything else, but does have a relation to the Constitution, and I think it's very significant. Actually, it is connected to some of the things we've been doing recently. As you know, in the past couple of weeks, we've touched more than once on the issue of America's two-party system and the extent to which it is built upon the idea of moderation and compromise and negotiation. And of course, my agenda, my issue, has been basically that we're reaching a point of dysfunction and division within the two-party system, because we are focusing on issues where negotiation, compromise, and middle-of-the-road positions are not possible. And I think it is throwing a monkey wrench into the ability of our two-party system to deal with these issues. Related to that is another issue that I'd like to talk about, because I think it's directly connected to that. And it speaks to the inevitability of the day that you can only kick the can down the road so long on a petition, and that there's a barrier or a brick wall there that keeps you from kicking it any further. What I'm saying is that at some point in time, we as a nation, as a people, are going to have to deal with a number of these issues. We may choose for the moment to postpone the decision on them, but the fact of the matter is, at some point in time, they're going to have to be dealt with. And sometimes, not dealing with them right at the beginning, at front, that by the time you deal with them, they'd be much more awesome and overwhelming would have been if dealt with earlier on. It's to know that, because you're dealing with alternative history. You know, you're basically dealing with what happened didn't happen, but instead has happened. And so the question I'm raising, for example, we talked a couple of days ago about the situation in the early 19th century in America leading up to the Civil War, and the extent to which the two parties became involved in the issue of slavery and began to take opposite positions on that very, very emotional and controversial issue. And one of the things we talked about was the fact that, the founders believed that you, if once you started to take these things on politically, you were in trouble at some point in time, because you were dealing with an issue where compromise and negotiation was not really possible. You were going to run out of wiggle room at some point in time, and you're going to have to deal with it. Jefferson knew that. Jefferson's reference to it as a fire bell in the night, it seems to me, says very clearly that at some point in time we're going to have to deal with this. And I guess the issue that I'm raising right now is sometimes when you're confronted with those kinds of things, maybe it's better to deal with them right up front before the issue grows and begins to grow tentacles and begin to reach out in so many different areas that by the time you really do decide that you have to deal with it, it becomes even more overwhelming than it appears at the beginning. Personally, I'm into this a little bit sometimes because it kind of raises as a subtopic or as an aside the issue of procrastination, and I don't know that there's a medal for such things, but if there was, I'd have one. I'm probably one of the world's best procrastinators. My wife is more than, reminds me of that more often than I'm comfortable with, and I really can't respond because she's exactly right. You know, I mean, sometimes I think I live by the, according to the, to the dictum, why do it today if you can postpone it until tomorrow? And of course, my wife is just the opposite. But sure, her idea is if we're going to have to deal with it, we'll just do it right now. And when you're dealing with something like slavery, for example, which is so emotional and has so many categories and connotations to it, that it's imposing. It's the kind of sense when you say hold off until you know really what. Because there's a lot of issues associated with this, and once we start we're gonna have to deal with them all. And so the argument is, because it's that big, let's hold it off until later. Maybe some of the side issues will disappear, the issue will become a little bit more clearly defined and a little bit easier to deal with. And of course we realize that while we hope that's going to happen, the fact of the matter is it rarely does. I kind of said that kind of fast. It sounded like I said it really does. I meant it rarely does. And so, as somebody that could be elected as the head procrastinator to represent the best interests of all other procrastinators on any number of issues, sometimes when I really think about it, I kind of say, there are certain issues of principle that everybody is going to have to deal with at some point in time. And maybe the people that say it's easier if you deal with them now than it is if you postpone them till later, in some of these cases, may be right. And I kind of ask myself as a historian, what would have happened if the founders dealt with the slavery issue in 1776 when Jefferson brought forth his first draft of the Declaration of Independence with that huge paragraph in there about slavery and the slave trade and the extent to which the king was responsible, because he's the one that basically initiated the slave trade between the British merchants and the American colonies. And so consequently what Jefferson is trying to do is pin the responsibility for slavery and the trade and all the negatives associated with it on Great Britain, on the king. And that's a little bit extreme, as I realize that as I read this, that this is a little, we'll talk about passing the buck. And it's and Congress basically demands that Jefferson pull that out of the declaration before they'll approve a Declaration of Independence. So Congress never really deals with what Jefferson said, because they don't want anything in there about slavery at all. So the fact of the matter is they dodged the issue. And so the question is, what might have happened if they really took it on, head on? Would the history of the nation be different? Yeah, obviously it would have been, but in how? Would they have been able to find some way to compromise the issue would they have been possibly able to find some way to initiate the eventual end of destruction by charting some sort of a periodic step-by-step procedure whereby the South's economy would gradually diversify and the institution of slavery would gradually disappear? And of course, many people in the 1850s believed that slavery was doomed to fail anyway, because many of the newer territories of the United States in the West and the Southwest and the Northwest didn't seem to be conducive to slavery anyway. So the argument was, amongst many people, that slavery as we know it has pretty well reached its limits anyway. Let's just let it die. And I guess the question is, what would have happened if, in fact, we did that? And what happens, we did out postpone it. We kicked the issue road for a whole other group of elected representatives and a future Congress to deal with. And the sum total is the issue becomes bigger and bigger and bigger and more imposing as the decades go on, until finally we find ourselves in this incredible war in the early 1860s that cost in the neighborhood of 360,000 Northerners, just supporters of the Union. I mean, it's incredible what happens. And I guess the issue is, if we had dealt with it earlier, could we have avoided some of the worst aspects of that? But we didn't do it. And I would, my point here is that as I look at the American political system, the nature of our two-party system, and as I look at some of the other issues, associated with it, I begin to suspect that maybe what we're dealing with here is not so much a weakness on the part of the particular people who were confronted with the issue at a particular point in time. Maybe what we're dealing with instead is something a little bit more systemic than that, something that is inherent in the system, which makes it impossible for our system of two-party politics to really address anything this confusing and this complex and this emotional and this principled. And the reason I say that is for the most obvious reason that as the issue of slavery begins to heat up, and as people begin to take positions and sides on the issue, it's very clear that the issue becomes so emotional that once people take the position, they're not willing to negotiate or compromise at all. And so by definition, that makes it a little bit difficult, if not impossible, for it to be resolved within our political system, because compromise and negotiation is really the end-all and be-all of our political process here in America. And I can remember the other day making the point that in today's political world, we're dealing with not the slavery issue so much, but we're dealing with issues equally emotional, equally serious, equally non-negotiable and non-compromisable, and equally divisive. And they range from right to life. They range from assisted suicide to the death penalty to recreating life in the petri dish to and on and on and on. I mean, some real issues that really affect people where they tick, right at the core. And those are not the kind of issues you can negotiate on. And of course, Madison's point and Jefferson's point, as I mentioned the other day, is that what you've got to do is you've got to keep those issues off the political table. You can't make them the agenda in a political campaign and force people or ask people to take sides on issues that emotional, because you're not going to end up with anything but trouble. You're not going to end up in any way with a stronger community, because you're going to end up with a divided community. And so what you've got to do is take your cue from the history of this country and the nature of our two-party system, which has been that the strength of our system has been its ability to build community rather than divide community in our politics. And the way we've been able to do that is to dodge issues which were not conducive to the process of community building and consensus building. I wanted to give yet another example of that from the same period, and it deals with the same issue, slavery. So it's kind of a historical case study, if you will. And I think it just adds a little bit more substance to the issues and the questions at hand. What I want to do is illustrate what I think is one of the most important controversies in American history, at least in the 19th century, and it's, of course, the issue of the expanding of slavery into the territories. But what I'd like to do as well is frame this as a case study in contradiction and avoidance on the part of our political leaders. I don't know that it's conscious. Many times I think it is. For me, personally, one of the most eye-opening research papers that I ever did when I was in graduate school was on a piece of legislation enacted by Congress during the Woodrow Wilson administration, 1914, called the Clayton Act, Clayton Labor Relations Act. It was an act that, when it was passed in 1914, Samuel Gompers, who was at the time head of the AFL-CIO, the AFL, there was no CIO then, he called it Labor's Magna Carta, because it looked like, and it's progressive legislation, it's part of the progressive era, and and part of it acknowledged working people's right to organize and have their position heard and have a seat at the negotiation at the bargaining table and all the rest of it. So labor sees it as a very, very positive piece of legislation. And I was asked to do a research paper on it, and I did. I had no idea what I was going to say about it, because I didn't really know. I was more or less in the process of doing research. I was learning about it. I didn't know about it going in. And without getting into detail, one of the things I remember very well, and this happened, you know, I wrote this paper 40 years ago, 35 years ago. But one of the things I remember from that is that I was absolutely astounded by what the research was telling me. And what it was telling me is that the law was written in very vague language. It was written in a way which was absolutely riddled with loopholes. It was written in a way where one could find very few definitive statements. It almost seemed like everything the law seemed to do, it would end that particular section with a phrase that suggests that there may be times when we don't want to do this, so therefore we create an out. And what I began to see is that the way the legislation was written, it appeared to be a major victory for labor, but when push came to shove, and what I mean by that, when these issues ended up before the Supreme Court of the United States, especially a Supreme Court headed up by Chief Justice William Howard Taft, who was one of the leading conservative ideologues in the United States at the time, it became pretty obvious to me that those people who believed that the Clayton Act gave them certain rights and certain reasons and abilities and licensed to do certain things. We're going to find out once they got before the court that what they thought they had, they didn't. And indeed, that's what happened. And by the time we move into the 1920s, the voices of labor in America begin to argue that labor had been duped by Congress and by people that they thought were labor's friends, which were the progressives of the early 20th century, because they had passed at least a piece of legislation that seemed to give us everything, and as it's gone through the courts, we begin to realize that it gave us nothing. And as I began to read the legislation itself, I began to see the loopholes in the law. And so consequently, I was confronted with a dilemma. And the dilemma was a very simple one. It was a very obvious one, an understandable one. This particular law was drawn up by elected officials of Congress, members of the House, members of the Senate, Republicans and Democrats alike. The Congress of the United States, then as now, was populated by an inordinate number of attorneys. And so the question that becomes very obvious is, how could attorneys, people accomplished in the law, write legislation with so many loopholes in it unless they wanted to? Unless the Clayton Act was really not an effort to help labor at all, rather, it was really an effort to make labor think that government was responding and giving them many of the things that they wanted, when in fact it was filled with loopholes. But these things wouldn't come for many years until these issues worked their way through the courts. It would be another decade. There'd probably be a whole new group of people sitting in Congress by then who would have to deal with these things. We'll be gone. And one of the things I confronted that I had to deal with was the fact that this may be one of the biggest cases of kicking the can down the road I ever saw in my life, my young life at that time. I was a graduate student. It was one of the first research papers that I had ever written. At the time, I thought what I was proposing in my paper was revolutionary. I thought, oh my God, I'm going to get a zero. I'm going to fail this paper because some of the things I'm saying the professor sure isn't going to like. It just so happened that the professor in this course was Stanley Cutler. I got to learn about Stanley Cutler, and this is exactly the kind of thing he loved. But I didn't know that at the time. And what I realized after a time was that, in effect, this was just one more example of something that had been going on and on and on. And as we've talked about here at the Virtual Center, I've begun to realize that this, an awful lot of this went on during the Constitutional Convention itself. And so what I had blundered into in the Clayton Act of 1914 was not a revolutionary new phenomenon that had never been heard about before, but it was something that was regular practice in the nature of our political system. It's the way we do business. It's the way our political system has done business. And I guess what I'm saying is that very often there comes a time when you do business this way that these issues are going to come back and bite you. And sometimes they're going to bite you at times when it's not really convenient to be bitten. And I think we're beginning to realize that in a number of different areas. So with that kind of background, with that kind of context then, I'd like to go back a little bit into the 19th century and look at another aspect of the issue of slavery, and it's the legal issue, the constitutional issue. What I'm basically setting up here is the very famous Dred Scott decision of 1857. And what I'm doing is suggesting a series of precedents, of historical precedents, on this issue of the expansion of slavery into the territories that had happened over the previous 75, 80 years prior to 1857. And to recognize that in 1857, the newly elected President of the United States, James Buchanan, who was elected as a moderate, the nation had just been through what many of the textbooks refer to as Bleeding Kansas, a violent series of events in Kansas over the issue of slavery. The most prominent name associated with that is John Brown. And the outbreak of horrendous violence and butchery that occurred in Kansas, in part because of what the nation did, what Congress did, a few years earlier in 1854, in the passage of the so-called Kansas-Nebraska Act. But I kind of wanted to put that into context. So, if you will, we're at 39 minutes after the hour. We can probably get, complete a good portion of this by the time we reach the end of our first hour. I think it's a worthy exercise. Where I'd like to begin, I think it's a great place to begin questions and issues like this, is in the Constitution of the United States itself. Specifically, and I'm thumbing through a textbook that I have with a copy of the Constitution of the United States at the end in the appendix. And where I'm going in the Constitution is a place where people don't often go. And it's Article 4 of the Constitution of the United States. As we know, Article 1 deals with Congress. Article 2 deals with the executive branch, the presidency. Article 3 deals with the judiciary. I'm turning to argue Article 4, which deals with the powers and the prerogatives of the national government as an entity. And Article 5, of course, deals with the process of amending the Constitution. We've been talking about that. Article 6 is important because that's where the Constitution declares that this Constitution and the laws of the United States made under it will be the supreme law of the land. And then Article 7 deals with the process of ratification, how we will ratify this Constitution. I'd like to go to Article 4. We won't be there long. But specifically, I'd like to go to Article 4, Section 3 of the Constitution, to the second paragraph of Article 3, which deals with the territories of the United States. And Article 4, Section 3 says the following: "The Congress shall have power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States. And nothing in this Constitution shall be so construed as to prejudice any claims of the United States or of any particular states." Specifically, what I'd like to address is the fact that the Constitution of the United States specifically, definitively, assigns control over the territories of the United States to Congress. Congress shall manage and regulate the territories prior to the time that they apply for statehood as independent states. So what you have to do first is organize the territory and set up a territorial government and a territorial legislature. And you have to reach a certain proportion, a certain number of people, population, and then the powers that be in the territory apply for statehood as a state. And the Constitution basically provides that each state, once a community of the Union, will have all the powers and immunities and all the rest of it of every other state, and its citizens will and will enjoy the same thing. This process was included in the very famous Northwest Ordinance of 1787, which was adopted, created, before the Constitution of the United States was written. In other words, the Northwest Ordinance of 1787 is one of the real accomplishments of the Articles of Confederation Congress, to basically organize the territories and create a process and a procedure whereby territories become states within and under our Constitution, and citizens become citizens of the United States. That's one of the areas where our Articles of Confederation doesn't get nearly enough credit for some of the good things that it was able to do. And part of the reason for that, as we know, is that the people pushing the Constitution were doing everything they could to make the Articles of Confederation appear to be inept and in need of abolition, of getting rid of them. So there's no question then that the power over the territories, without question, definitively, is assigned to the Congress of the United States. Consequently, the assumption is that every time a question comes up related to the territories, that question is brought to Congress, because that's where the power over the territories resides. Article 4, Section 3 of the Constitution of the United States. In 1820, when the state of Missouri applies for statehood as a slave state, the whole issue of slavery and the expansion of slavery is raised, because the admission of Missouri as a slave state would give the South one more state than the North has. Put another way, it would give the South two more votes in the Senate than the non-slave-holding states would have. It would disrupt the balance between slave states and free states, which had pretty well dominated the structure of Congress up until this point in time. So the issue goes to Congress, and Congress is able to pull off one of the most famous compromises in American history, which is the compromise, the Missouri Compromise of 1820, by admitting Maine as a free state. Maine at this time, up until this time, was part of Massachusetts. Maine is able to break away from Massachusetts and apply for statehood as a separate state. And that resolves the dilemma of Missouri's application as a slave state, because to admit them both simultaneously would preserve the balance between slaves and free states in Congress, thereby preserving an equal number of senators, votes in the Senate for both sides, which would allow the South to maintain its veto power over anti-Southern, anti-slavery legislation that might be coming through Congress at any point in time. So the Missouri Compromise is the following. Missouri will be admitted into the Union as a slave state. Maine will be admitted into the Union as a free state. And here's the key. And from here on in, there will be no additional slave states admitted into the Union north of 3630 latitude, which is the southern border of Missouri. In other words, what Congress is doing is effectively drawing a line through the southern border of Missouri all the way across the country to the west, and is saying from here on in, the only state north of this line that has slavery will be Missouri, no more. And of course, the implication is that everything south of that line will be susceptible to slavery, and everything north of it won't be, except for Missouri. And that becomes the Missouri Compromise. And it's pretty well accepted by both sides. My point is, the reason it's accepted is because the Missouri Compromise is totally 100% consistent with Article 4, Section 3 of the Constitution, which gives Congress the power to decide what happens in the territories. When Congress says in 1820 there will be no more slavery north of 3630, it is doing exactly what Article 4, Section 3 of the Constitution says that Congress is supposed to do related to the territories. It is making the rules and regulations affecting the territories of the United States, because the territories of the United States, according to the Constitution, are assigned to Congress as the place where all needful rules and regulations respecting the territories will be made. So there's no question, no controversy about that at all. In other words, nobody raises the question that Congress can't do this, because the Constitution says it can. So far, we have no problem. But lo and behold, along comes the 1850s. And in the 1850s, the Union is experiencing this tremendous burst of growth and expansion, economic growth. And one of the key features of that growth is the building of railroads. And Stephen A. Douglas of Missouri seizes the opportunity to propose legislation to create a transcontinental railroad connecting the West Coast, Los Angeles, with the East by building a railroad across the central part of the nation. As a citizen and representative of the state of Illinois, Douglas wants a northern route for that railroad, because there is a proposed southern route which would run the railroad across through southern states to California. Douglas wants the railroad to run from Chicago, which is in Illinois, to the West Coast. The problem is that in order to lure investments, in order to attract investors, the territory in the middle part of the country would have to be organized. There's no way in the world that investors are going to invest their money to build a railroad across territory, across land, that is not organized, that is not governed, that is not peaceful, that is controlled. By Indian savages, as it were. So because of Douglas's interest to represent the best interests of the state of Missouri and the city of Chicago, and because, from what we understand, Douglas was heavily invested in railroads, he had a vested interest in stock and railroads, Douglas proposes an alternative transcontinental railroad to the southern route. And it would begin in Chicago, and it would run through the northern plains, through the Rockies, into the West Coast. And as part of that proposal, Douglas proposes the organization of the Nebraska Territory. The problem is that you've got the Nebraska Territory, and right south of it, you've got the Kansas Territory. So Douglas proposes the organization of the Nebraska Territory and the organization of the Kansas Territory. It is generally concluded in Congress that because the Nebraska Territory is north of Kansas, it'll probably not be conducive to slavery. Most people assume that the Nebraska Territory will not have slavery. But many Southerners believe that the Kansas Territory south of that could have slavery. So Douglas is faced with a political dilemma. In order to get the Kansas-Nebraska Act through Congress, he's got to win the South's support, political support. He's got to get Southern votes. And the only way he can get Southern votes is to offer something to the South. The North is going to get the railroad. What's the South going to get? Douglas proposes that the Kansas Territory will deal with the issue of slavery on the basis of what the textbooks call popular sovereignty, majority rule. What we'll do is we'll let the people who live in Kansas make the decision on slavery, by the only way that's fair, which is a vote and majority rule. So in effect, what he's done is, in order to win this Transcontinental Railroad for the North, he's got to offer some sort of carrot to the South. And that carrot is the opportunity to make Kansas a slave state by winning the vote when the time comes to hold that vote. The Southern delegates immediately see an opportunity. And immediately address the issue to Douglas. Mr. Douglas, according to the Missouri Compromise of 1820, Congress has mandated that there will not be slavery in any of the territory north of 3630. That means that Kansas can't have slavery. But now you're saying that it will by majority vote. There seems to be a contradiction here. Will you accept an amendment to your bill which would point out that the Missouri Compromise of 1820, which prohibited slavery in Kansas, is no longer in effect, is null and void? Douglas accepts that amendment, and it becomes part of the Kansas-Nebraska Act. So the Kansas-Nebraska Act is that the territory of Kansas, and by Nebraska, we're not talking just about what is now the state of Nebraska. At that time, the Nebraska Territory was all the territory north of Kansas, which would include not only the current state of Nebraska, but South Dakota and North Dakota and Idaho, and you know, all of the territory in the central part of the United States, all the way up to the Canadian border, becomes the Nebraska Territory. And the conclusion is it doesn't have a chance of having slavery. But the focus is on Kansas. So Douglas's bill is that the territory of Nebraska will be organized, the territory of Kansas will be organized, and the slavery issue in Kansas will be addressed by popular sovereignty, by the vote of the people who live there. And that means that the Missouri Compromise of 1820, which prohibited slavery in Kansas, is hereafter null and void. Suddenly, the South has an opportunity to expand slavery into a place where it didn't believe that it had an opportunity to do so. Obviously, the North, anti-slavery people in the North go nuts, because Douglas has opened the Pandora's box. He's raised an issue that they thought was settled. More than that, he's effectively converted Kansas into Madison Square Garden when it comes to the slavery issue, because both sides realize that if we can get enough of our people in there, we can win this vote. And so immediately people from both the North and the South begin to flood into Kansas. It's a tinderbox, it's a time bomb, it's only a matter of time before it goes off, and it goes off in the person of John Brown. So the nation has been through the violence and the horror and the bloodshed of Kansas in 1854, 1855. You end up with a divided Kansas with two constitutions, a free constitution and a slave constitution. And ultimately, Congress has to make the decision as to which is the legitimate government of Kansas, and they pick the pro-slavery constitution, which is the popular sovereignty one. And the nation is looking at the possibility of all hell breaking out over the issue of slavery. And they're looking for a way to cool the situation down, and they turn to a moderate named James Buchanan from Pennsylvania as President of the United States in 1856. And when Buchanan comes into office, he basically promises the people of America that the Supreme Court is currently working on a case which, once it's resolved, will settle the slavery issue forever, and it'll be off the table, and we won't have to worry about it anymore. And within a week after Buchanan's inaugural, the Supreme Court issues its very famous decision in Dred Scott. It's an incredible story. It's in every single textbook from the first grade on, but it's not told in a way which makes anybody sense. It's an incredible story. And now it's going to really come to a head with Dred Scott. But we have reached the top of the hour, so let's pause and take a 5-minute break and get our bearings and stand up and stretch and take a breath, and then we'll come back and we'll begin our second hour here at the Virtual Center. I'm Bill O'Brien. You are listening to the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility. After a short break, we'll be right back.
done, another hour to go. Dr. Bill O'Brien now returns to the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility.
Thank you, Bob Kincaid, and thank you for that wonderful music. It's terrific. All I was sitting here saying, hey, Mr. DJ, do you know this one? And good stuff, good stuff.
That's a little band called Outre-mer, from a record called Garage à Toi.
Oh, man, I love it. I love it.
Glad you liked it.
I do. I did. I really did, Bob. Thanks. Welcome to the Virtual Center. And for those of you just joining us, first of all, I want to thank you and welcome you. And for those who have been with us through the first hour, I want to thank you for staying with us. As you know, we were in the midst of a story. And the purpose of that story is the unfolding of the slavery in the territories issues in the 1850s, which leads to the Civil War. And the purpose of this is not just to tell stories, and it's not just to basically look back at history, but I hope that I've been successful in elaborating and articulating the point of the story. And the point is that what we are witnessing here is a history of the nation's political inability to deal with controversial issues. And in order to dodge and sidestep those issues, and in order to dodge and divide the principles, for very, very legitimate reasons, please don't get me wrong, I'm not putting them down. This is serious stuff. This is really emotional. And most elected representatives realize that that these are no-win issues. And the only way to deal with these things is to find a way around them. And maybe you can postpone it for a while and hope that later on somebody else will come up with a better solution. It's a very human response. So I don't mean to at all belittle the fact that these issues are very, very serious. But the reality is, and we looked at the Constitution, we looked at the Missouri Compromise, we looked at the nation operating on the assumption that the Congress of the United States in the Constitution was given exclusive authority to make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territories. Effectively, that meant, and the Missouri Compromise kind of confirmed, that on the issue of slavery in the territories, it was Congress's decision to make. And Congress made that decision in the Missouri Compromise by allowing Missouri to come into the Union as a slave state, along with Maine as a free state, in order to preserve the balance, and also by stating definitively that no other state north of the southern border of Missouri, 3630 latitude, would be admitted into the Union as a slave state. In other words, there'd be no more slavery north of 3630. And that works for a while. It's very consistent with the Constitution. And so while there were debates and discussions on the Missouri Compromise itself, nobody raised the issue whether Congress had the right to even legislate on this, because the Constitution clearly in Article 4, Section 3 gave Congress that right. So that's not debatable. But again, because of the circumstances and the situation that the nation faces in the 1850s with the development of railroads and the issue of a northern route versus a southern route, and of course Douglas, coming from Missouri and representing Missouri, wants Chicago to be the eastern terminus of the Transcontinental Railroad, that means that he has to basically initiate the organization of the Nebraska and Kansas Territory and get it through Congress. And so he does that, but in order to get Southern votes for it, he's got to give the South something. And the something he gives them is the possibility of slavery in Kansas by majority rule of the people living there. The one point that I didn't make it earlier, that I guess we could make now, I was going to hold it for later, but I think we can make it now, is that there's obviously an inconsistency or a contradiction between the Missouri Compromise and the Kansas-Nebraska Act. Because if the Missouri Compromise had denied the possibility of slavery north of 3630, i.e. in Kansas, and now Douglas is opening up the possibility of there being slavery in Kansas if the majority of the people who live there want it, then the Kansas-Nebraska Act effectively seems to contradict and violate the Missouri Compromise. It can't be both. Either Congress decides and makes rules and regulations respecting the territories, or the majority of people living there make the rules and regulations affecting the territories. But you can't have both. So the fact of the matter is, the South makes it very clear to Douglas that by addressing the slavery issue in Kansas around the principle of popular sovereignty, aren't you effectively negating the Missouri Compromise? And of course, Douglas is forced to admit that indeed he is. And so the South's position is, then put that in your damn bill. I don't think they said it quite that way, but that's the way I see it. Anyway, so the result is the Kansas-Nebraska Act organizes the territories of Kansas and Nebraska. The issue of slavery in Kansas will be determined by popular sovereignty. And the Missouri Compromise of 1820, which denied the possibility of slavery in Kansas, is no longer valid. It is now null and void. So, excuse the phone. And then, of course, in 1857, after bleeding Kansas, comes the election of Buchanan and the promise that the Supreme Court is going to settle the issue once and for all. And within the week, the Supreme Court renders its decision in the very famous case of Dred Scott. And most of us remember that story because, in our school books and our teachers have been more than willing over the years to tell the basic story of Dred Scott. Dred Scott was a slave in Virginia, and he was sold, and his new owner brought him to St. Louis and then brought him into the Wisconsin Territory, which at that time included the state of Minnesota, what becomes the state of Minnesota, and they lived there for a number of years. Dred Scott was married, had kids, two kids, I believe. And then his owner brings him back into slave territory again, back south. And so the issue is, does the fact that Dred Scott resided for so long in free territory mean that he's no longer a slave? And he and his attorneys obviously argue that it is, that it does, and that he is no longer a slave. And it goes to the courts, and this becomes the Supreme Court decision to make in the case of Dred Scott versus Sanford in 1857. And it's one of the most famous decisions that the Supreme Court ever made. Historians who studied the court argue that it's one of the most unfortunate decisions that the Supreme Court ever made. Justice Roger B. Taney is the Chief Justice, and he writes a decision. But in this particular case, every single member of the court writes a separate decision. So when we say the Supreme Court decided, what we're talking about here is that while each justice wrote a decision, the fact of the matter is the bulk of them all reached, the majority of the court reached the same conclusion. And the conclusion was, and of course everybody cites Taney's because Taney's is the chief, Taney is the Chief Justice. The position of the court, majority of the court, is that Dred Scott was a slave, which meant that he was property of his owner. And property does not cease to be property because of where it is, where it resides. And so the court's argument is that whether, in fact, Dred Scott lived in free territory or not, the fact of the matter is he was a slave and he remained a slave. And consequently, the mere fact that he was a slave meant that he didn't even have the right to file this case before the Supreme Court in the first place because he wasn't a citizen. He wasn't even considered a person. But the most important part of the case is that the Supreme Court heard it. And the reason they heard it, obviously they could have dodged the issue by refusing to hear the case on the argument that Dred Scott, because he was a slave, didn't have the right to file it. But the court didn't do that. And of course the reason for that is because this is a decision that the court wants to make. And it's fairly obvious that the reason the court wants to make it is because the ultimate purpose here is to resolve the slavery issue once and for all, which is what President Buchanan has promised the nation. The decision is that because Dred Scott was property, he was a slave and remains a slave. And as property, his owner has the right to take his property anywhere he wants to take him. And any body or any law that prohibits an owner from taking his property where he chooses to go is a violation of the slave owner's rights to property under the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution, which says that no person will be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And for anybody, any state or territory, to enact legislation making it illegal for a slave owner to bring his property into that state or into that territory is a direct violation of the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. And then comes the obvious kicker. Justice Taney adds that since the Missouri Compromise of 1820 prohibited slavery north of 3630 latitude, then that meant that the Missouri Compromise of 1820 contradicted the Fifth Amendment, broke the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, and therefore was always unconstitutional from the get-go. The Missouri Compromise of 1820, of course, it had been negated 3 years earlier in the Kansas-Nebraska Act, but now the court is saying it was never constitutional anyway because it was directly in violation of the Fifth Amendment. There's absolutely no... Of course, this is a tremendous victory for the South. But there's absolutely no question that the Supreme Court believed, Taney believed, that this decision would once and for all settle the issue of slavery, where it could go and where it couldn't go. And with all sorts of signs and signals that Southern states were threatening to secede from the Union, there's no question that Buchanan, the President, and Taney, the Chief Justice, and the other members of the court believed that in rendering this decision, they were doing their patriotic duty to preserve the Union by keeping the Union together, keeping the South in the Union by resolving this issue. It turns out, of course, that the Dred Scott decision, as I mentioned, is usually considered to be a very unfortunate one for the Supreme Court. Historians of the courts will argue that it took 50 years for the Supreme Court to recover from the negative publicity and the negative feedback that the court received over Dred Scott. It was considered to be a major, major faux pas. But the interesting thing is that while many people in the North, and one of the biggest spokesmen against Dred Scott is Abraham Lincoln, we'll get to that in a minute, nobody talks about abolishing the Supreme Court. They talk about changing the nature of the court, changing the makeup of the court in order to overturn the decision. But nobody's talking about abolishing the Supreme Court and changing the Constitution by eliminating the court. I think that's important to recognize. But there's absolutely no question that the series of political debates that break out later in 1857 and 1858 during the campaign for the United States Senate in Illinois between Stephen Douglas and Lincoln revolve principally around the position that these two gentlemen take on Dred Scott. Dred Scott creates a virtual revolution in the North because anti-slavery people, and Lincoln obviously is one, anti-slavery people make the point that what the Supreme Court has effectively done is open up the entire nation to the existence of slavery. If the Supreme Court said that nobody can stop a slave owner from bringing his slave into Kansas or into Wisconsin or wherever, then that means that he can also bring his slave into Boston or New York or Baltimore or anywhere that he wants to go. Effectively, what the Dred Scott decision does is open up the entire country to the institution of slavery, to the possibility of having slavery. Not only that, but at least where the slavery issue is concerned, it redefines the role of the federal government and turns the federal government into an agent of the slave system in the South. Because by definition, the Supreme Court must use its offices to defend or to catch runaway slaves, the fugitive slave laws. The federal government is rendered the employee and the agent of slavery. Because in order to uphold the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution, it must protect the right of slave owners to take slaves wherever they want to take them. In a sense, what it does is that even though Lincoln loses the election for the United States Senate in Illinois to Stephen Douglas, the Republican Party realizes that they want Lincoln as their candidate in the election of 1860. And the Republican platform is very clear: no more expansion of slavery anywhere. And the reaction to that of the South is, if Lincoln wins the election, we have to leave the Union. we will leave the Union. What I want to, the point that I want to make to this whole thing, and this is, it's an incredible story, I think, but there is a point. And the point is, put yourself in the position of the Supreme Court. Your job is to interpret the Constitution, to interpret the law. As one person has mentioned, the role of the court is to say what the law is. So you look at the precedents, the legal precedents, the evidence, the facts. You do your research. And what you see is that the Constitution of the United States gives control over the territories to Congress. The Kansas-Nebraska Act gives control over the slavery issue in Kansas to the majority of the people living there. And now the Supreme Court in Dred Scott is basically saying that the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution effectively protects the right and the freedom, the liberty of the slave owner to take his property wherever he chooses to go. Which means that Congress has no right to prohibit slavery from any of the territories. Not only that, but the majority of the people can't limit slavery because it would be a violation of the Fifth Amendment. So the fact of the matter is the Supreme Court in Dred Scott is confronted with, I believe, an impossible dilemma. They have a number of competing and contradictory precedents on which they could have gone any number of different ways. It's pretty obvious that they went the way that they thought would be best for the Union. Obviously, history has indicated that it was the wrong decision, and war resulted. Now we're confronted with the question we opened with. Is this entire scenario an example of what might happen, what happens when you avoid dealing with the issues at hand and you try to dodge them or evade them or address them in such a way that they seem to deal with the issue, but in reality, later on, it becomes clear that they really didn't. There were too many loopholes. And if that's true, then you have to recognize the fact that these are laws written by corporate attorneys, by attorneys, who are word masters when it comes to legalisms. All you have to do is look at the Constitutional Convention to recognize that. And you have to conclude that if the issues were not dealt with forthrightly, it's because the political leaders at the time chose not to address these issues forthrightly. And I would argue that the reality is that is the nature of our political process, of our political system, which is based on compromise and negotiation. And the only way to avoid this kind of an impossible dilemma from coming up is to not allow issues like slavery to end up on the political agenda in the first place. They're too emotional, they're too decisive, and whatever decision you reach, you're going to irritate somebody. Really irritate somebody, because there's no middle ground, there's no moderate position. And so, in a sense, what the history of the nation during the early 19th century to me demonstrates is a series of obfuscation and innuendo on the part of Congress which primarily indicates to me a decision, a determination not to make a decision, but to avoid making one, while at the same time appearing to. Hoping that at some future time, circumstances would change, the issues would be much more clearly defined, the temper of the nation would change. It might be easier later to deal with this issue, but right now, this is the only way we can find a way to deal with it without creating turmoil. Maybe the Civil War itself, and the fact that it happened, is an indication that our two-party system, our political system, is not really capable of dealing with some of these issues. Now, if that's true, and of course I've never, here at the Virtual Center, but even beyond that, in my life, I've never really dealt with this as a reality. Let's say that that's true. What are your alternatives? Well, obviously, the most obvious alternative is to control the political system in such a way that when the decision is made, it's the one that you agree with. Because the issue is so emotional and so heart-wrenching that you can't live with a loss, you've got to win. I think, very honestly, that's what we're dealing with right now in our politics with Obamacare, with the Affordable Care Act, and with the Tea Party, that ultimately this is the ultimate struggle for power. And what concerns me, as I think it's become very obvious, what concerns me more than anything else right now is that we're going to see a situation where people are going to be able to use the provisions of the Constitution and the thinking of the founders themselves to justify the calling of a constitutional convention and make the kind of changes in our political system that would totally undo and overturn and destroy the nature of this republic that has been in existence for 240 some odd years. And I think we're letting it happen. And I think part of the reason it's happening is because of the communication revolution and the media and technology. I think what we're witnessing is the technological opportunity in this country to organize a national effort and to hold together political coalitions that are larger and broader and more widespread than they've ever been before. There was no way in the world before to organize this kind of thing, but now technology and communications, contemporary communications, make it possible to do that. You can organize a national movement and hold it together. I think, you know, I'm amazed, as I'm sure you are, by the fact that nobody ever seems to break ranks. That the votes on issues in the Congress are absolutely predictable and infallible. They can tell going in exactly who's going to vote which way on which issues. And so the nature of our political system, of our two-party system, has become such that the two parties are dividing on issues that the electorate has never had the opportunity to really vote on. Because the nature of our two-party systems has made our elections candidate-focused rather than issue-focused. Our parties traditionally have been non-responsible parties. We elect people to make the right decisions for us, but we do not know going in what those decisions will be. We were not given an agenda of the party with a commitment that if we elect this candidate, that candidate will vote for this agenda. We've never been given that option. That's what parliamentary systems do in nations in Scandinavia and Great Britain and some of the West Germany and some of these places. Our system has been candidate focused rather than issue focused. Our voters have been pretty much conditioned to vote for the candidate, not the agenda, not the party, not the office. And the assumption is that what we're electing are independent decision makers. But what we're seeing in our political system right now is that there's very little independence left on the part of our elected officials, because they are voting the party line invariably. They never veer from it. The vote is never up for grabs. The votes are never in doubt. Sometimes they're not sure whether the speaker, before they bring a bill to the floor, will not be sure that he has the requisite number of votes to get it passed. But it's going to always be close. They have some idea going in as to how everybody's going to vote. But that's not a decision that the people have ever been offered the chance to make. It's the decision that is being made once they get in office. And what we're getting, what we're seeing, is that through the process of gerrymandering districts, we're getting hand-picked candidates with no political baggage, no political history, novices, who are being elected to office in gerrymandering districts, not because of their intelligence or their experience or anything else, but rather because of what they believe and what they are willing to do if they get elected. They are basically committing, if I'm elected, I will vote exactly according to this agenda. And there's no way in gerrymandering districts that there's really a feasible possibility of getting these people out of office, which means that they have no accountability to the electorate. They're there as long as the people who put them there want them to stay there. There's no accountability, there's no responsibility, there's no ability of the people as an electorate to hold their elected officials accountable, except in this kind of sham way where, because of gerrymandering, all the people who want the representative to do the right thing are in the same district. And so consequently, there's no contrary, there's no alternative voice, there's no opposition, there's no debate. And so what we see then is, from the national perspective, some of these elected representatives are taking unbelievably wild positions on issues and are saying unbelievable things, and they aren't being held accountable or criticized by their constituents, those who voted for them. They're being praised because they're doing exactly what the people in their district want them to do, because the district has been artificially created around this particular issue. And so I think that the nation is on the cusp of some serious, serious decisions and issues. And I think the potential of a second convention, constitutional convention, is probably the most important one, but it's only one of the issues. I think the issue of reciprocity and accountability between the voters and the elected officials has been seriously damaged in this nation, in our political system. And I think the track record of our political system, of our party leaders, to address issues like this in the past has not been a good one. I don't know how you feel, and I know that this is obviously open to interpretation, and my heavens, there's probably more books that have been written around the Civil War than anything else in American history. it's something that everybody has a strong position in. Everybody has a feeling about and a position on, et cetera, et cetera. And everybody claims to be an expert, and I don't. But I would suggest that clearly one way to look at this period is to conclude that the fact that there was a civil war speaks to the failure of our political leaders to avoid it. And maybe the result of that the situation had finally come down to the point that was no way in the world to avoid it any longer. All the negotiation had happened. All the compromises had been reached. There was really no way to get around it anymore. There was no way to kick the can down the road any further, because what you had done is reach a situation where, when it came to the key question of expanding slavery into the territories, you had a series of contradictory pieces of legislation passed through the years to the point that you had a mess. In fact, one of the students in my class referred to it as a mess. And asked and made this comment, which I thought was pretty powerful. Are you suggesting that Douglass's principal motive was railroads, and in order to promote the railroads and increase the value of the stock that he held, that he might have instituted a legislation which ultimately caused the war? Are you saying that this mess is because somebody wanted to get rich on railroad investments? That was the question I was asked in class. And my answer has to be, well, I don't know if I'm saying that. Maybe it sounds like I am saying that, but I don't really know if I want to go so far as to say that. I really like to believe, and I can convince myself that this is partly true, that just as the Supreme Court felt that it was resolving the issue for the good of the nation in Dred Scott, I kind of like to think that Douglass believed that he was as well with the idea of majority rule, popular sovereignty in Kansas and Nebraska. I really think that what Douglass was doing, in part at least, was to go for the same solution to problems that many of us had been taught to from the time we were children. And that is, the only fair way to make a decision is to have a vote. It's the fairest, most just way to reach a decision when there's more than one option possible, when there's choice to be made. If you're going to do it democratically, then that's the best way, that's the fairest way. And of course, one of the things that majority rule has going for it is that it's very, very hard politically to argue against it. It's very hard to be the one who's arguing against majority rule democracy. How do you do that without looking like a bigot, or looking like an elitist? And so if you claim to support the principle of majority rule as the fairest way to make a decision, then it stands to reason that when you come up against a crisis, you kind of turn to that for your answer, for your solution. And what you're basically saying is, well, it's beyond me. Let's just turn it over to the people and see how the people want. We'll just go with whatever they decide. So what you kind of do is passing the buck a little bit. And I think that's maybe what Douglass was doing. I think he really believed that by coming up with the idea of popular sovereignty, of majority rule, he was coming up with a way to handle the slavery issue in Kansas, which nobody could argue against, because as a nation, we've been committed forever to the principle of majority rule. Let the majority decide. Let the people decide. But the fact of the matter is, when you throw it up to majority rule, you're almost inviting chaos. because you're causing both sides to pack Kansas in order that they'll have the majority and win the vote. So I don't know. I like to believe that Douglas had the nation's best interests as much at heart as the Supreme Court did in Dred Scott, as I believe that the Supreme Court did in Dred Scott. But the fact of the matter is, it was not the right decision for a lot of. I mean, it was easy to legitimately justify legally. There's absolutely no question the Missouri Compromise contradicted the Fifth Amendment to the in the Bill of Rights, because it violated the rights of property owners, because the law had defined slaves as property. And the Fifth Amendment said that no person will be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. There's no question, then, that the Missouri Compromise, by prohibiting slavery north of a certain place, north of a certain line, violated that principle. So my conclusion to all of this is that I think what we're looking at is a Supreme Court that really was given an impossible task. And the reason they were given the impossible task is because for so long before that, political leaders had dodged, had kicked the can, whatever phrase you want to, or expression you want to use, had refused to really confront the issue head on. And the reason they refused to confront it head on is because it was so controversial. It was not conducive to compromise. It was not conducive to negotiation. And that's really what's necessary for our system to work. So the only answer to that question is to make sure that you're on the winning side, or, and this or is what I really want to emphasize, we moved into the last quarter of the last 15 minutes of our program here. The point that I really want to emphasize here is, it seems to me the real answer is to keep these kinds of issues off the table. Don't ask people their political opinions on issues around which on which they cannot compromise, they cannot negotiate. Do not present issues to voters that deal with absolutes. This is right and that's wrong. The people that agree with me are right. The people that disagree with me are wrong. All the people on my side have white hats. All the people on the other side have black hats. The people who agree with me are in the right. They have truth and right on their side. The implication is those who disagree with me have just the opposite. They are the forces of the devil. If I'm right, they're wrong. If I'm good, they're bad. If I'm noble, they're evil. There's no way in the world to artificially create and maintain a political community with issues like that on the table. So if your number one priority is preservation of the political system and the building of a sense of community and a sense of camaraderie and reciprocity between people and their elected officials, which is really what the basis of Republican government is, then it becomes very important to control the issues that get on the table, but more important, to keep the issues that don't belong on the table off it. And I would suggest that all the mistakes that American history teaches us from the 1850s leading up to the Civil War have come around full cycle as we look at what's going on in our nation today. we have people getting elected and taking positions on issues where there is no negotiation, no compromise, no wiggle room possible. We have people bombing abortion clinics. We have people taking the law into their own hands. Vigilantism is on the rise. And we have done this. Not only that, but because of our commitment to free speech and the other rights associated with the Bill of Rights, we're giving people the freedom to vent on these issues. The one I'm thinking of specifically right now is the international foreign policy issue between, you know, that is emerging in the world between Christianity and Islam. We are giving voice, giving vent to people that are preaching hate in a society, in a political system, in a national community which cannot accommodate hate. We are a diverse population. We have a variety of different religions and different races and different nationalities and different backgrounds and different income levels and all the rest of it. And in order to govern it, it's absolutely essential not only to create but to maintain a sense of camaraderie and community within that nation. It's the only way to govern it. What that means is you've got to find a way to steer clear of issues that divide and inflame, because the potential for violence and hostility and vigilantism is always there in a diverse society. James Madison said you have two choices. You can eliminate factions by making sure that there aren't any, by making sure that everybody has the same interests and the same passions. In other words, everybody agrees on the same things. And he points out that that's not possible. Or you can take away people's freedom to carry through, to follow their prejudices, to act out their prejudices and their inclinations to violence and disagreement. And Madison said in our system, freedom, liberty, individual liberty is a priority. And to do anything about that would be a disease, would be a cure worse than the disease. So you can't take away people's freedom, and you can't make everybody the same. So that means you've got to deal with diversity. You've got to accept diversity as a fact of life, and you've got to find a way to govern within that context, within that kind of an environment. And the only way to do it, and I'm preaching, but I can't help it. The only way to do it is to control the issues that get on the table and keep the ones that shouldn't get on the table off it. The ones that are going to divide can't get there. You've got to make your political decisions on issues where compromise and negotiation and wiggle room is possible, where people who think differently on the issues can come together and reach accord and agree to work together to make certain things happen and to try to turn what would be victory for one side and defeat for the other into what the business people refer to as a win-win situation where everybody gets something. But you can't do that on the kind of emotionally charged issues like slavery in the 19th century and today like abortion and gender and lifestyle and these kinds of issues where people's positions are driven by things like religion. You've got to keep that off. Madison and Jefferson knew that. That's why they wanted to separate politics and religion, church and state. Because when you bring those two things together, you're just asking for nothing but trouble. Yet somehow we have allowed ourselves to fall into a situation where we're allowing people with very, very clear, definitive positions on issues to be defined by their religion. And we're giving them the opportunity to take those and carry them into the political arena. And asking the electorate to take sides on those issues, you're just asking for what the nation went through in Kansas in 1850, in the mid-1850s. You're throwing these controversial issues into the middle and saying, majority wins. Everybody go after it. The majority wins. You can't make these kinds of decisions on these issues. Madison believed that they had to be kept separate. They had to be kept private. And what you had to do is encourage people to be religious. It's not that you're anti-God or anti-religion or anything else. You're very pro-religion because you begin to recognize, nobody said this better than Benjamin Rush. You recognize very clearly that religion is so important to the development of good habits and morality and proper behavior and respect for other people and all the values that we cherish are part of a strong religious background and a strong religious heritage. So you want to promote religion and encourage people to turn to it in order to wrestle and make these kinds of difficult decisions. But you don't want to offer the opportunity of turning political power over to them if they can organize a majority. That's suicide. And one other point that I think kind of ties in with this, and it's the idea of the controversy between Christianity and Islam. Because people on one side are more than willing to criticize the fundamentalism and extremism on the other side, while at the same time not recognizing that the more committed they are to a certain set of truths and absolutes on their side makes them as fundamentalist as those they are criticizing and those toward whom they are preaching hate. When you hear people talk about truths and these things, are the things I believe are absolute, and I know that because I believe them and they're in the Bible or they're in Scripture or whatever. When people are coming from that kind of a position, you can't basically allow them to take those positions into the political arena. They have to be defined and confined to the private, into something that remains totally private. When these issues make their way into the political arena, then the political arena is in trouble. And government begins to scurry and do two steps and all of the rest trying to dodge these issues because they're no-win situations. You can't take positions on this when one half believes one way and one half believes the other. And so what you're going to end up doing is creating a series of political mistakes. And at some point down the road, somebody like the Supreme Court in 1857 is going to be asked to resolve this. And you can't do it. It's too late. I think this is an incredibly important topic and issue. I think these principles are really important to reflect upon. It is now 59 minutes after the hour, and our time today is done. Our time this week is done. I want to thank you for tuning into the Virtual Center. I want to invite you to stay tuned for Bob Kincaid and his program here on the Head On Radio Network. And I want to invite you to join us when we get back together again next Monday. Thank you.
Bob Kincaid, 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Clear on my Mac on iTunes. Bob reports Randy in our Pennsylvania listening station. 2 minutes past the hour. Another brilliant 2 hours with Dr. Bill O'Brien. Again, I encourage you to, if you can't listen live, take the podcast for Dr. Bill. You will be more historically literate about the origins and institutions of this country than by listening to any other broadcaster, period. It's that simple. Dr. Bill O'Brien is, of course, on from Monday to Wednesday of any given week from 4 to 6 p.m. with occasional forays into 3 to 5 based on his scheduling needs. Thank you, Dr. Bill. Thank you. So here it is, Wednesday, middle of the week, second day on the air after returning from my whirlwind but magnificent trip to northern Wisconsin. I hope you all got a chance to hear Jeff Biggers on the program last night. I think he had information that was very, very important for all of us. And a note from Duncan, our chat room moderator and moderator of the host of the Horn Molloy Skype chat group. That's the gang that gets together and chats after Molloy's over at 12:05, 5 past midnight Eastern time, that is. And Duncan received a pitch from the Sierra Club, all about ending mountaintop removal. Curiously, that pitch from the Sierra Club, talking about ending mountaintop removal, had absolutely no mention whatsoever of the only, and let me repeat, only bill in Congress with the power to end mountaintop removal. Doesn't that seem a bit strange? Thanks, Jeremy. Vermont Reporting Station, loud and clear on TuneIn. Thank you very much. But really, here's the Sierra Club saying that they want to end mountaintop removal. And let me pull it up here real quick so I can get to it. Texas Reporting Station in. Thank you, Betsy. Loud and clear in Texas. Ain't the intertubes grand? The EPA just failed us. Bruce Niles, Senior Director of Beyond Coal Campaign of the Sierra Club, says, instead of protecting our health and water, they gave... Hey, look, no mention of the air. Oh, damn. I guess we still got some uphill learning curve work to do with the Sierra Club. Instead of protecting our health and water, they gave polluters another free pass to destroy Appalachian streams and rivers with mountaintop removal mining pollution. Never mind the ultra-fine particulate dust that's so small that it can pass through the pores of individual cell membranes and wreak all manner of havoc. Who cares? I mean, the EPA doesn't. They don't even have a standard for dealing with ultrafine particulates, right? Despite, Bruce Niles, right? Despite hearing from over 41,000 people, the EPA bowed to pressure from the coal industry and allowed Kentucky to relax protections on toxic selenium pollution from mountaintop removal mines. Selenium pollution, which causes significant biological damage to fish! leaches into our rivers and streams from the blown-off mountaintop rock and dirt. Really? Really? The fish get higher billing from the Sierra Club than the human beings do. Isn't that just lovely?
Lovely.
Shame on the EPA for putting the interests of big coal before that of Appalachian fish. No, communities, waterways, and wildlife. The EPA has allowed Kentucky to change. Yada, yada, yada. Thanks for all you do. Send a petition to the EPA. And then there's the one that Duncan saw, which talks about, let's see here. Yeah, there it is. Raise your voice. End mountaintop removal coal mining. Mountaintop removal coal mining blows off the tops of mountains to extract the coal that fuels our nation's power plants. Oh, for F's sake. Really, guys? I mean, somebody at the Sierra Club is seriously mailing it in. What about the export market, Sierra Club? Oh, wait, you don't want to mention the export market, because that's got lots of, every year more stuff leaves Appalachia on a boat. Well, I mean, first a truck, then a train, then a boat, and goes to foreign countries. European countries, even. Places like Denmark. Germany, no less. Mountaintop removal coal mining blows off the tops of mountains to extract the coal that fuels our nation's power plants. It, and steel mills in India, and steel mills in Russia, and steel mills in China, and power plants in China, and power plants in Russia, and power plants in India, and power plants in Denmark, and power plants in... You get the idea. It has already leveled 500 mountains and buried over 1,200 miles of streams, but it gets worse. It raises the risk of... Oh, look! Humans! Instead of fish! It raises the risk of birth defects, cancer, and heart disease for local communities. They noticed! Well, bust my buttons! Right now, wait a minute, next paragraph, right now dozens of permits are pending for new mines and the Obama administration could approve them any day. If they get approved, it will mean more people get sick and more mountains get destroyed. What about the fish? Take 30 seconds right now and tell the White House to put our communities and their health first. End mountaintop removal coal mining. Personalize the message text on the right with your own words if you wish. And that's the whole thing. This link has been put on the Horn Facebook page. So run on over that away. But here, let me cut to the chase. There's not a blessed mention of the only bill in the Congress of the United States that would end mountaintop removal. They are as silent as the tomb about H.R. 526, the 8th Act. Maybe it's because they don't control it. Maybe it's because they're not so very particularly happy with the hillbillies out there doing stuff on their own. You know, we waited around for the Sierra Club to get their thumbs out of their asses, both of them, for in excess of a decade. And they just kept marching and sending petitions and fooling around in the administrative system and hosting demonstrations and bullshit. And that's how the AIC Act got born. We got tired of waiting around for the people that told us they were ever so much smarter than us to do something about it.
while our friends, our neighbors, our loved ones, our fellow Appalachians got sick and died. Excess deaths, the statisticians call them. We know them as grandma, or a baby nephew, or a wife, or a husband, or a sister, or a brother, or a cousin, or an aunt, or an uncle, mother, or father. But here's the upshot. You can do what Duncan did. Duncan responded to that petition with the following. It's time to end mountaintop removal coal mining. Pass the AIC Act now, H.R. 526, the only bill in Congress that will end mountaintop removal. You know, maybe if they start seeing a few of these things, they might actually figure out a way to pay attention. What? Oh my God, Biffy. Look, the hillbillies are trying to do something. Don't they realize we fundraise a positive shitload of money on their hillbilly backs? Yeah. Couldn't even be bothered to, and you know, just so we're clear, you know why they didn't mention the export market? Because the Sierra Club has $50 million from Michael Bloomberg. All for the purpose of shutting down coal-fired power plants in the United States. And they could shut down every coal-fired power plant in the United States, and our mountains and our communities would still go boom to the tune of about 5.5 million pounds of high explosives per day. And our friends, our friends, our neighbors, our wives, cousins, brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, nephews, nieces, neighbors, colleagues, co-workers, would still be finding themselves periodically sitting in a doctor's office with a doctor with a grim look on her face saying, well, you know, you got cancer.
But I thought the Sierra Club stopped all the coal-fired power plants.
Well, they did, sunshine. But there's still tons and tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of coal getting on trucks and trains and boats and leaving Appalachia. Because, you know, really, you hillbillies just aren't that important. So maybe pass the word around. Go to the Head On Radio Network, go to the Horn Facebook page, and follow the link, and go tell them. Tell them it's time to get serious about the ACAC. Tell them that the Obama administration's EPA administrative rules can be changed with the next president. We need a law that forbids this from happening, and the only one out there is the AIC Act. So, take action if you care to. And then, having take action, and this is kind of a big deal, share it. Share it around. Send it around. Explain that the Sierra Club has, and the Natural Resources Defense Council and others, have left Appalachia flapping in the breeze. The coal dust-laden breeze. The ultra-fine particulate dust-laden breeze. It sure would be nice. I don't tell anybody to do anything. But if you would be willing to go and do something like this, it would be really, really helpful. Okay? Thanks. This is not, of course, to say that I don't know what today is. Today is Prayer Meeting Wednesday. Tim, you're getting way too highfalutin there in the chat room. Today is Bible Study Wednesday? No, Tim, this is Prayer Meeting Wednesday. You got to get in the hillbilly spirit of things. And I am proud to announce this Prayer Meeting Wednesday that I had a note from our good friend Robert up over in Australia. Once again, it's time for the 20th of the month Up Over Down Under Challenge. I'll match the first $50 donated today with $50 of my own. And, of course, it would be nice if someone or someone's matched that with another 50. And greetings to one and all from the land of Oz. Thank you, Robert. Thank you. Hopefully that'll get us going in a nice way. Because we're in a deep, horn going off the air kind of hole. It is in excess of, near $500. So if folks will match Robert's offer, that'll bring us down to near $400. And it, well, it's badly needed. Because, you know, once again, I remind you, we don't run any ads here. We don't try to direct you to. We're not delivering you to potential commercial relationships. But yes, indeed, I do know what today is. It's ever so much more than Wednesday or hump day. More than the middle of the week, more than downhill to Friday. It is, in fact, prayer meeting Wednesday on the horn, as noted. And it's time, we had our fellowship dinner, and the deacons are all filled up with pineapple upside down cake this evening. You'd be surprised. They will actually fight one another, those deacons will, for the slices with the little red cherry in the middle of the pineapple ring. I never understand why, but they come near to fisticuffs. But we chased them in out of the parking lot where they were having their postprandial cigarette out there with the sinners, ran them through the vestibule, down past the bowl of 20-year-old desiccated butter mints, and all the way down into the front row, where when they start to snoozing, I can get them with the flip gun. Thank you, Asa. Thank you very, very much. Asa has responded to Robert's challenge, and if you would like to respond to Asa, that will get us well on the way to getting us at least up to eye level above the hole. So thank you very much, Asa. So now, with everybody in the pews and with the deacons getting ready for their nap, and thank you, Betsy. Betsy has taken up the challenge and met half of what Asa sent. Thank you very kindly. So another $25 and we will have met Asa, and we'll build it that way. Thank you very much. But now, with the deacons ready for their late autumnal snooze, we will bring the Minister of Music forward for the offertory hymn. Brother Minister of Music, if you would,
ladies and gentlemen, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, let me hear you say, Amen.
Amen.
Let me hear you say, Praise the Lord.
Praise the Lord.
Let me hear you say, I will empty the contents of my wallet into that little collection plate when it comes around.
I will empty the contents of my wallet into that little plate when it comes around.
And it's all tax-free. Hallelujah.
Hallelujah.
Praise the Lord for all the cash I've got. Praise Him for my Rolls Royce and my yacht. Serving God ain't hard with a credit card. Jesus died so I could make a lot. Praise the Lord, He's made us millionaires. Wave your donations in the air. We've replaced our hymns with ATMs, and soon we'll charge a fee on every prayer. Jesus Christ was a poor man, don't you know? He should have used our accountants for his cash flow. Stop the Sermon on the Mount, he should have had a bank account. 2,000 years with interest, he'd be rolling in the dough. Praise the Lord, this song's out on CD, just $40.95 plus GST. Hallelujah, plenty of moolah, solitaire baubles on my Christmas tree. I've got all of heaven's riches, thanks to all you stupid bitches. Praise the Lord for modern Christianity. Whoever said religion should be free?
Oh, Mary'sy dotes and dozy dotes and little lambsy davy, a kiddly davy too. Wouldn't you? Wouldn't you? I love you. Welcome, brethren and sistren. Come on down that blood-red aisle and fall on your knees at the altar and lay your hands upon the subwoofer and feel the healing rays of common sense a-flowing through you from the server on. I am Archpope Uber Rabbi, ultimate imam, antagonized agnostic, animated animist, Bob Kincaid. And this here is the Cathedral of Common Sense Prayer Meeting Wednesday edition. Glory, hallelujah. We've got, brethren and sistren, we've got two stories of faithful, grace-filled, Bible-believing Christianity for you this evening. Yes, we do. Hallelujah. We go down to Alabama, stand, brethren and sisters, where David Ferguson of the Raw Story reached out to a Bible-believing Christian by the name of Duane Bridges. That's Duane, not D-Wayne. That's Duane. Say it right, just like he said, "Do Lord, oh, do Lord, oh, do remember me, up away beyond Galilee." Hallelujah, amen. Praise his holy name. Duane Bridges is a representing in the Alabama legislature. And Duane Bridges has got him a law he wants to pass for the people of Alabamistan. He's trying to amend the Alabama State Constitution, which was passed in like 1905 or some such, and is about a million pages long from previous amendments. Mm-hmm. And that constitutional amendment would allow public schools and other state properties, maybe the county landfill, for instance, to display the Ten Commandments. And the folks over there to the Raw Story, they called Duane Bridges, not D-Wayne, damn it. He's liable to get irksome if you call him D-Wayne or Dwayne. He's Duane Bridges. And Duane Bridges wants to remend the Alabama Stand Constitution so that they can put the Ten Commandments up all over the place if the state of Alabama happens to own it. So when the Raw Story reached out to representing Duane Bridges to ask if a similar effort would be made to display Judaic and Islamic documents, well, he got all head up and hung up the demon telephone. Mm-hmm. Praise. Representing Duane Bridges done said on the telephone about his HB 45, "Well, that's not the way I feel," meaning he didn't feel like it would be a stupid thing to sit there and waste millions and millions of taxpayer dollars in conservative family values Alabama stand to defend a law that is patently unconstitutional, or would be if we had sane people, or at least a majority of sane people, on the bench of the Supreme Court of the United States. But until then, it's a complete crapshoot. He said, "That's not the way I feel," because, you know, how you feel when you're presenting unconstitutional legislation, that's your real litmus test. I've had it checked out, Duane Bridges said, and it won't just be the Ten Commandments, if that's what you're referring to. There'll be historical documents with it. And I don't know if Duane Bridges realizes this, being as how he has an itsy-bitsy, teeny-tiny little pinprick of a brain. He probably didn't. But he just admitted that the Ten Commandments ain't historical. There'll be historical documents with it. Which is rather reminiscent of the great big right-wing religion industry hissy fit recently being thrown against the heathens over to the Costco. I wish we had a Costco around here. Come on, guys, please. Some of us would like to never, ever, ever, ever enter Sam's Club or Wally World again for as long as we live. Give us somewhere to go. Build it, and they will shop. But a fine, upstanding, God-fearing, Bible-believing Christian went on down to his local Costco because I reckon he needed a new Bible. Maybe he'd wore the ink plum off the other one. But he was a wandering around the Costco and said, "Where's the Bibles?" "Welcome to Costco. I love you." He says, "Where's the Bibles?" And they point him to the book rack. And imagine his horror. This upstanding, God-fearing, Bible-believing, California-living Christian, when he goes back to where Costco keeps all the books, and he picks him up a Bible, and it's got a price tag on it. Well, I mean, they all do. My goodness gracious, the Bible has a price tag on it that we can't even begin to contemplate, doesn't it? But no, it has a price tag on it. And I think the Bible was $14.99. But here's what got the Pastor Caleb Kaltenbach of Simi Valley, California, all hot and bothered and be under his bonnet and burr under his saddle. That sticker on that Bible and all of them Bibles said $14.99 fiction. That's only because they don't have a, I guess that's only because they don't have a bullshit section for, never mind. Yes, indeed. He said, "All the Bibles were labeled as fiction. It seemed bizarre to me." Well, Brother Caleb, I would suggest you read your book because there's all kinds of bizarre in there. Women getting turned into salt and kings of Israel cavorting and smollicking and lollygagging around with concubines in traditional family marriages and people getting thrown in pits and patriarchs are telling Pharaoh that their wife is their sister. "She's my sister! She's my sister!" Yeah. And pimping her out. Oh, my goodness gracious. Sun standing still in the sky because, you know, it revolves around the earth. There's all kinds of bizarre crap in there. Somehow or another, charging $14.99 for a book and calling it fiction doesn't even, I mean, it really doesn't, it don't matter. It don't measure up on the bizarre scale once you've opened that book, Brother Caleb Kaltenbach. So he immediately got on the phone to his flock there at the non-denominational Discovery Church because it seemed bizarre to him. He said, "People are pretty shocked and upset. We're supposed to be living in an era of tolerance, but what Costco did doesn't seem too tolerant." "If they don't believe in the Bible," he said, "that's fine. They're going to hell. But at least label it as religion, as some bookstores do, or inspiration." Yeah, that's what I'd like to label it as, inspiration. I mean, there's nothing more inspirational than God telling people to go and commit a genocide. Man, that's some inspiration. Or telling his prophet to go marry a hooker. Yeah. Ah, man. On the one hand, Christians should not yell out we aren't living in Iraq or Iran. But on the other hand, I believe that we do need to stand up for our faith and we need to be vocal about our concerns, you know, because God's not big enough to stand up by himself. He's kind of got to be propped up by all the little Bible-believing Christians. Over at Costco, once they got done snickering, they said a spokesperson for from Costco said this was a result of human error at a warehouse. You know how that translates, right? Hey, Leroy, quit labeling the Bibles as fiction. Little fundy weirdos don't take kindly to it. All right. Can I label it as horror next month, boss? We'll see. And Todd Starnes over to the Radio Rwanda Fox News, he said there's still a boatload of Bibles that's marked fiction at the Simi Valley store. Robert Jeffress, you remember Robert Jeffress? He's the one who said that Bishop Willard Romney belonged to a cult. Because they're real good at talking about who doesn't believe the right way, but they don't like it at all if you tell them that their book is a load of baloney. That's kind of rough on baloney, though, isn't it? Robert Jeffress of Dallas, Texas, Stan, said, "Let's hope Costco's explanation is true and not the result of having been caught attempting to marginalize the very foundation of Christian beliefs, the Bible. Christians need to call out organizations like Costco, whose actions undermine Christianity." Imagine that, a retail wholesale club has the power to undermine 2,000 years of terror religion. They need to be called out, regardless of whether those actions are accidental or intentional. Wait a minute, I didn't see any calling out part in the New Testament there in all them red letters in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John, but I did see a whole lot about forgiving. Brother Jeffress, you think maybe you might want to reach out and forgive Costco instead, like your holy man Zombie does? Done told you to do? Yeah, don't count on it. The Christians are also largely upset because Costco pays a living wage to its workers, by the way. But I've been taken away from my original intent because we were talking about Duane Bridges. Duane, do remember me. Sorry. So they asked Duane about whether there'd be any Islamic text or Judaism text or maybe a little something something from the Rig Veda or the a little something or another from the Bhagavad Gita. No, he said, "You're wrong. Our country wasn't founded on the Koran or anything else. It was founded on godly principles. So that's what you need to put in there. Thank you." Click. America wasn't founded on the Koran. And, you know, no one would probably be more likely to agree with Duane Bridges than a creep by the name of WMAL's Chris Plant. He shows up over on Radio Rwanda Fox News pretty often. And I'm sorry I didn't get to it yesterday. We were just kind of covered up in stories and whatnot. But fact of the matter is, the right wing is done having themselves a hissy over that one in our White House, a reading of the Gettysburg Address. See that brilliant little filmmaker, Ken Burns, who got his start making a film about the Civil War, which can be argued as both a brilliant piece of, and a sort of redefinition of the whole paradigm of documentary filmmaking, or characterized as a wholesale misunderstanding of the entire Civil War as history. It was working on a project to mark the 150th anniversary of Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. So he took a copy of the. There are multiple versions of the Gettysburg Address, and I can't help wondering if maybe Ken Burns was having a little fun at the president's expense, because he knows how these right-wing freaks, these Bible-believing Christians and conservatives and birthers and deathers and truthers and booger-eaters and would respond. Because he took the Nicolay version of the Gettysburg Address, which was the first version of the Gettysburg Address, and simply asked President Obama to read it in front of a video camera. Here's the rub, and here's why the story shows up on prayer meeting Wednesday. The Nicolay version does not include the two words "under God." Because, see, as much as they don't like to acknowledge it, Abraham Lincoln was not a fundamentalist, Bible-thumping, snake-handling, strychnine-swigging, floor-rolling, tongue-speaking freak. He took an Enlightenment approach to religion, saying, believe as you will and leave me alone. Occasionally he would make reference to providence in his speeches, and ultimately in the Gettysburg Address he referenced one nation under God. But he didn't say which God, or which particular theocratic or theologic definition of him, whether he was, the Trinity didn't come into it, or all those things that Christians lopped each other's heads off over for the first 400 years of the new religion. Abraham Lincoln was a complex personality. He was iffy on slavery, having notably said that if he could keep the Union together and keep slavery, he would gladly do so. Complex man. You can still, in Washington, D.C., at the little church across from Lafayette Park, you can see his pew. He was rather of a back row type, I do believe. He would wander over from time to time just to see what the gospel sharps were talking about on any given Sunday. But no, the right-wingers have gotten themselves, they have gotten their maiden forms into an absolute Gordian knot over this one. Because that one in our White House didn't say under God. Don't trust me for this. Oh, no. Let's check him out. This is from WMAL. This happened yesterday. And it is precious.
That's kind of peculiar. Gee, it's kind of like the way he changed Obamacare, you know? He looks at the 2,400-page bill and the thousands of pages of accompanying regulations, and when he decides that something doesn't work, he just scratches that out and says, we won't enforce that. I'll just suggest to the insurance companies that they violate the law of the land. It's settled law. Now, violate it, because I say so. And here's the Gettysburg Address, as carved into the wall of the Lincoln Memorial on the Mall, our sacred mall in Washington, D.C. The Gettysburg Address, on this, the 150th anniversary, the first black president, with Abraham Lincoln's speech, the first Republican president, and somehow these words just hit the cutting room floor. Under God. And those, only those words. Isn't that fascinating? Let's go to the telephones. What?
Yeah, let's go. Isn't that fascinating? Isn't it fascinating that the director of a film has the right to have the words he wants spoken the way he wants them spoken in the film? Isn't that fascinating? Isn't it fascinating that what do you call him, Barack Hussein Obama? Didn't that hit every time he said his name, Barack Hussein Obama? Yeah. Cut! Mr. President, no, we gave you the version that doesn't have under God in it. Could you read it according to the script, please? Barack Obama reads the Gettysburg Address, Nicolay version, take two, and roll 'em! so that this nation undergot cut. You did it again, Mr. President. Oh, did I? I'm terribly sorry. President Obama reads the Nicolay version of the Gettysburg Address, take three. Roll them. Isn't that fascinating? Because, see, there are multiple versions. One that says under God and one that doesn't. I wish Ken Burns had given him the under God version, for heaven's sake, so that people like Chris Plante of WMAL wouldn't have this to fulminate over. Let's go to the phones, he said.
Why does it matter? Why do you care? There are those who are going to say, this is not a story. You're just, you know, who cares? What are you making this up for? You know who they are. Let me go to Rob in Fairfax. Rob, you're on the Chris Plante Show.
Hey, Chris, thanks. I think it matters a lot. It's the same way that the Democrats can, I guess, rewrite history and prove to the world, or prove to everyone, that the Republicans are the KKK. He who has the power...
Huh? Damn, and here I find myself another Wednesday without tequila. The Democrat? Where'd that come from? And look, we can't get 15 seconds into a caller conversation on a right-wing radio station talking about the President of the United States without an oblique reference to the Ku Klux Klan.
Or writes history. So if he can take God out of his speeches now, when next year or the year after or years from now, when they built...
Because he did. He took it right out there. He had his little pencil. I cannot tolerate under God for...
Start using his speech instead of Lincoln's speech.
Oh, what is this dart inside my neck? much better now. Oh, that inscrutable, that one in our White House. My, oh, my, oh, my. He's going to substitute his speech for the Gettysburg Address, and then it'll probably become part of Common Core, and little children will then... Oh, Jesus.
Oh, that's good. That's, and you know what? You're right.
Now wait all night for calls like these.
I mean, you know, here's the Gettysburg Address as delivered by Barack Obama. He becomes the new standard bearer for the Gettysburg Address. And
yeah,
oops.
Got everyone else drinking Kool-Aid. So, I mean, it, what he says is already true. So if he says it wasn't there, then it wasn't there.
You know,
of course, he didn't say it wasn't there. Now, I mean, this is sort of an exercise in just, oh, look what an idiot the right-wingers are. We do this a lot. But this is also a bit of a language and framing, and perhaps a sociological exercise as well. Because you'll notice the fact that Ken Burns specifically requested the reading of the Nicolay version of the Gettysburg Address appears nowhere. And so the little wingnuts with what passed for brains just leaking out of there and running down their necks and dribbling onto the floor... Ken Burns had nothing to just. It's him, that one.
They go to
all of the misinformed people.
President Obama and his fellow travelers, followers. There are followers of President Obama who have fought to have, for example, under God, taken out of the Pledge of Allegiance. All right. And they can't do that by fiat, but Barack Obama can do it by fiat here. And when he's going through,
Ferrari?
What? Barack Obama and his people have the Gettysburg Address in front of them, and they're sitting up in, you know, leather wing chairs at the White House with a red pencil going through the speech, and they scratch.
And of course, it has to be a red pencil. Actually, I think you'd use a blue one but no, it's red because they're, you know, Satan.
Out under God, and then pass it to Barack Obama, and he reads it that way. I mean, how does something like this happen? How stupid are these people? How dishonest are these? How fundamentally corrupt, morally and otherwise corrupt, are these people? It's astonishing to me. I mean, and it just plays...
It would be astonishing if there was even a hen's tooth worth of truth in this. Wholly, absolutely, utterly corrupt. Because I guess it's too much work for... Chris Plante conservative radio host and frequent Fox News guest, to simply understand that there are two versions, and that Barack Hussein Obama, as he describes him, was called upon to read one of them. Because it's ever so much fun to go after Barack Hussein Obama, because you get to say Hussein a lot, you know, and that means he was probably Saddam's cousin, and then you say that a lot, and because Ken Hussein Burns just doesn't have the same cachet, does it? Nope. Nope. Oh, Lord, it's fun. The fundies you have always with you. And then, of course, and a number of you sent this story to me, including our buddy Tim from L.A., profiles in Christian Courage. Dateline, Hazleton, Pennsylvania. Where Emmanuel Paulino has been taken into custody after first trying to fight the police. Having raped a woman. I will spare you the details and say merely that they... There's no non-brutal rape. There's no friendly rape. There's no casual rape. Rape is rape. But apparently under the influence of something called Molly, the crystalline version of MDMA, which I find difficult to believe because MDMA has never been really documented as promoting violence or anything, but apparently the victim and as well as Emmanuel Paulino both took it and decided to engage in sex. At which point, Emmanuel Paulino decided to transform it into rape that resulted in a woman being seriously physically harmed, intestinally damaged. And her screams were so awful that they brought her children into the room, at which point 911 was called. She was found in a fetal position, the victim was. So Emmanuel Paulino was arrested after some trouble. Emmanuel Paulino has a rap sheet that includes things like aggravated assault, aggravated indecent assault, rape, involuntary deviant sexual intercourse, and sexual assault. He is presently charged. Oh, that is what he has been charged with. That's not his rap sheet. I apologize. That's just what he's been charged with. Aggravated assault, aggravated indecent assault, rape, involuntary deviant sexual intercourse, and sexual assault. And aggravated assault was filed against him for headbutting the first officer who tried to take him into custody. Having been arrested, they took him before Magisterial District Judge James Dixon there in Hazleton, Pennsylvania. This was late last night. Being informed of the charges against him by the magistrate, and this is why this is a profile in Christian Courage, Emmanuel Paulino responded that he is not concerned about the charges against him because, and this is a quote, "I have Jesus on my side." That's right, Jesus is on the side of accused rapists whose victims suffer what are described as severe internal trauma. Jesus, and you know, he's right. I mean, that's the theology of Christianity. All he has to do is ask Jesus for forgiveness, and Jesus forgives him. It's all forgiven. Now, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania may take a slightly more stern view, one would hope, of the problem. But he's already been forgiven under Christian theology. Isn't that lovely? This gives you hope for the whole human race, doesn't it? Yeah. Tim from L.A. with a question. Hey, Bob. Isn't Costco a corporation, and didn't these same whining Christians support free market capitalism? Well, yes, they do. It's right there in the 13th chapter of the second book of Flip-Floppians, I believe. Maybe they'll put the Bible in the porn section or toilet paper section next time. Oh, and there is a good use for the Bible. A college friend who landed in the California Department of Corrections in Chino, California, said, "You can ask for all the Bibles you want. What's the Bible good for?" You get the Bible with the really thin, thin pages. Awesome rolling paper. Thanks, Tim. And it is here at about 9 minutes before the hour on this prayer meeting Wednesday. It is time for our quote of the week. Coming from, well, we referenced it last week, the book of Hosea. He says, Bob, I know you like, Jay Cruzen says, Bob, I know you like the King James Version, but I can't give this one to you in the King James because that version took Israel out of the text. Why? I don't know. Maybe Betsy can tell you. And I think Betsy reminded us last week that the book of Hosea is sort of an after-the-fact argument about who's going to have power in the eternal disputes between Judah, the kingdom of Judah, and the kingdom of Israel. The glory of, this is Hosea 9:11 through 16. This is our reading this evening. The glory of Israel will fly away like a bird, for your children will die at birth, or perish in the womb, or never even be conceived. Even if your children do survive to grow up, I will take them from you. It will be a terrible day when I turn away and leave you alone. I have watched Israel become as beautiful and pleasant as Tyre. But now Israel will bring out her children to be slaughtered. O Lord, what should I request for your people? I will ask for wombs that don't give birth and breasts that give no milk. The Lord says, all their wickedness began at Gilgal. There I began to hate them. And that's tough when the Lord begins to hate you. I will drive them from my land because of their evil actions. I will love them no more because all their leaders are rebels. Way down yonder in the land of Gilgal. The people of Israel are stricken. Their roots are dried up. They will bear no more fruit. And if they give birth, I will slaughter their beloved children. Thus saith the God of love, the all-loving creator of the universe. And that is your bloodthirsty, all-loving creator of the universe quote for this week. From our buddy Jay Cruz. Thank you, kind. And thank you, Jay Cruz. He helped out, as did our buddy Sal, to put us... Let's see, so Asa responded to Robert in Australia and matched that 50, and then Jay Cruzen and Betsy responded to Asa with that 50, and Sal has then responded thusly, and we're halfway to raising another matching 50, which is exactly the way that Robert was hoping it would play out in his note for this evening's Down Under, Up Over Australia, Land of Oz Challenge. Thank you for getting it all started, Robert, and thank you, everybody, for participating. And then our buddy Luda has pushed it a little further. He has joined in. He says, here's a 50. Tell everyone to match it. My only condition is that you remind the listeners about Obama finally recognizing the last Native Code talkers. What a great Native American Heritage Month. Thank you. So now we stand with $25 to go to match what has gone forward. And yes, President Obama did recognize the last Native Code Talkers. And it was a beautiful thing. Even the Republican and the Democratic member of the Senate found something to agree on in doing that, from Republican and Democratic member from South Dakota. Because everyone remembers that there were Navajo Code Talkers, but there were also Lakota Code Talkers and Code Talkers from other Native American tribes whose words were absolutely incomprehensible to the fascists on the other side of that world encompassing war. So yes, absolutely. It was recognition long overdue, and arguably in the bigger picture, still not enough. Which brings me to some non-prayer meeting material. I found this over at a website called lastrealindians.com. You may recall that not last week, but the week before, there was a great tribal, a great big meeting of tribal leaders in Washington, D.C. And on November the 13th, President Obama and the administration held their fifth annual Tribal Nations Conference. Fifth annual. That means this has only been going on for as long as President Obama has been in office. Okay. First inclination is to say that's a step forward. That's not a bad idea. Sure. And President Obama came and addressed the leaders. I happened to have a conversation last week about this speech. I read some of the news reports about it, but I didn't see a lot of reportage in there in the for-profit media of the fact that some of those tribal leaders got up and walked the hell out. The story I'm reading at that website, lastrealindians.com, is by Matt Remley. Matt Remley writes, Obama addressed the conference attendees during the afternoon session, and towards the end of Obama's speech, he began talking about tribal lands, climate change, and energy development. His leaps from being, because there was all this stuff about how we must acknowledge that tribal peoples have always been good stewards of their land, and that they bear a special relationship with the land. That kind of stuff. Okay, that's good. We can all sort of work within those boundaries. But then, as Matt Remley writes, his leaps from being a good steward of native lands to the negative impacts on tribal lands from climate change to energy development. Oh, no. Energy development. This is a direct quote from the speech that Barack Obama gave to the fifth annual Tribal Nations Conference. And then the fourth area that we've got to work on is, let's keep our covenants